More and more fun. You know, I've noticed that from week to week. It's fantastic. Well, we're going to begin a brand new series this morning in John chapter 11. So if you have your Bible, I invite you to take it out, turn to John chapter 11. If you didn't bring a Bible, I think you got the bulletin. There's a message note sheet there that has a lot of the passages on it, so you could look at that. Or I think in the pew in front of you, there might be a Bible, or you could connect on your iPhone to YouVersion. Or your iPad to YouVersion or some kind of, you know, whatever you've got, and connect in, and you'll find the notes there. You'll find the scripture passages as well. So there are a lot of different options for looking at this passage. We're going to look at John 11 for today and the next couple of weeks. I think it's going to be really encouraging. Today we talk about the whole area of care. The concept is that if you care for somebody, you usually are willing to help them. Aren't you? Usually if you care, you express it in some kind of help towards somebody. So, for instance, we were away on vacation the last couple of weeks, and last week I drove over to Merced, California to visit with family over there, and on the way over, after driving over the Pachico Pass, dropped Dan into Santa Nella. How many of you have been to Santa Nella? Oh yeah, all of you. Wow. Isn't that a cool place to visit? Town of 1,300 people. It has one elementary school, and it has a Starbucks. So I stopped at the Starbucks on the way over to Merced, and after I got my little drink there, I noticed that there were some students that were sitting in the seats, you know, the soft chairs, of course, but the students were in these soft chairs, and they had Westmont College sweatshirts on, and I thought, oh, I got to talk to them because I'm a graduate of Westmont College in Santa Barbara. So I walked over, and I heard somebody else here is a graduate. That's good. So I walked over, and I said, hey, what are you guys doing? How are you doing? You're on your way back to school. And they said, yes, we're on our way back, but actually our car broke down. So we're stranded here. They began to explain to me how they were driving from Sacramento all the way back to Santa Barbara, and for some reason the car broke right there. The girl whose car it is said, you know, I just got this thing fixed a couple of days ago. Anyway, we're stuck here. And so I made a phone call to my mother, and mom's on her way to pick us up, and she's going to drive us from here all the way to Santa Barbara. And I thought, that's the kind of things moms and dads do, right? You call them up and you say, hey, I got a problem. And because we care, or we want to care, we do things like that for our children, right? So recently, for instance, my daughter, Katie, who's in her 20s, she called me up. She lives in Merced. She said the car won't start. And she wanted me to do something about it. Here I am in this area. She's over in Merced. And so I did my best to diagnose the problem over the phone. And I got lucky on this one. The battery was dead, okay? So, wow, I figured that one out. And so we talked about how a man friend can help her with that. And that's one of the wonderful things about having man friends in your life. You know, you could, can you come over and fix my battery? Oh, I love you. Of course I would do that kind of thing for you. And I don't know if he loves her or not, but anyway, so, you know, the point is that, you know, dads, when they hear something like that from a daughter, because we want to be caring, we care, and so we'll do the best that we can, even over the phone. Or we were in Texas over the break. We were in Austin with our oldest son and daughter-in-law, Danielle, Brent and Danielle, and their little baby, Annabelle, who's 4 months old. And while we were there, she was on her regular sleeping pattern, which means that she doesn't really sleep all night long, and she gets up really early in the morning, like around 5 or 6 or something like that. And because we are caring parents, we said, or at least we want to be caring parents, at least for a week we wanted to be a caring parent. We said, if you need any help, let us know. And so every morning about 6 a.m., we got a text message that said, Annabelle's awake. Would you like to come over and take care of her? And so we went over and we would take care of her every morning. Why? Because caring people like to help out, don't they? And so you all know this. I mean, even as students, if you care and your parents, you know, ask you to take the trash out, then you'll take the trash out, of course, right? Because you care. Or, you know, you husbands, if you really care, you'll clean the toilet because All right, we won't go there because that's the kind of thing, you know, a husband should do, or, you know, somebody's got to do it, or because you go out and fill the car up with gas because you want to show that you care, or maybe somebody's sick in your house right now, and so you were the one that went over to the drugstore to pick up the prescription, even though every time you go to the drugstore to pick up the prescription, it takes about an hour. Right? As you're waiting for them, oh, when is this ever going to happen? I did one of those this week because Bernice needed a prescription. And so, you know, that's just all kinds of stuff that we do, right? We say that it's the religious thing to do. True religion, James talks about, doesn't just say to somebody, be warmed, be filled, but true religion actually does something to help a person who's in need. We would say that's a godly thing to do. Which is interesting, because if that's a godly thing to do, then wouldn't you think that when we come to God with a need, he would do something to express his care? Wouldn't you think? Now, it's interesting, because some of us are sitting in this building this morning, and we've been bringing our concerns, our needs to God, and it just seems like he doesn't care. God, I need a job. And it's been weeks, and it's maybe even been months. I don't know. It could be years. And it feels like he doesn't care. You find yourself in a financial situation. You've gone to God. Things haven't changed. And it seems like he doesn't care. You're having a hard time with your parents. Your parents are having a hard time with you. We've gone to God over this, and nothing has changed. It seems like he doesn't change, or he doesn't care. We have relational issues. You know, God, I need a significant other, you say. I need somebody in my life. You know, Lord, remember way back in the first part of the Bible where it talks about how it's not good for a man to be alone or a woman to be alone? Well, I really don't like this being alone thing, so please bring somebody into my life. And it seems like he doesn't really care because nothing is changing. And you've been praying about that depression problem or that anxiety problem or that problem with fear. And it just seems like he doesn't care. Or you have a health situation right now that's not going away. It doesn't seem like it's improving. In fact, you're afraid to go back and get the report because it's possible it's going to tell you something that you really don't want to know. And you've been talking to God about it, and it just seems like he doesn't care. And it's because of that that we can use some help with the viewpoint that we have when we come to God and we ask him for help, and it seems like he's doing nothing to help us right now, having been asked. We could use some help with our viewpoint. And that's why John chapter 11 is so important. So let's look at this together, because this gives us a perspective that helps us in a time where we might be tempted to ask, or we are asking, does God really care? Look at how the story begins, John 11. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Now, the word love here is the word that we get Philadelphia from, phileo or philia. It is the word that speaks about a brotherly love or this wonderful relationship. So like a friendship kind of love. And what we see here is you see a person who is sick. This isn't unusual. And in this particular case, these people have a friendship with Jesus, a loving relationship with Jesus, a special relationship, even to the point that Jesus had been in their home. In fact, on one occasion, Jesus taught them about the importance of the eternal over the temporal when Martha was in the kitchen doing all the stuff and she was sidetracked by the most important thing. That all happened in their home. This is the person that was anointed with oil, as it says here, or perfume where this woman, Mary, came and anointed Jesus' feet. And so they had a special relationship, and can't you get the picture here, where if you have a friendship with somebody and you go to them with a need, you're hoping that they're going to do something about that need. They're going to enter into their need, the need with you. They're going to show in some way that they care. So we could really summarize these three verses here with two words: please help. They send out help, a help message to Jesus, and basically say, Lord, would you please help? Lazarus is sick. And evidently it was a sickness that was not going away. It's no different than what that student did at Starbucks when she called her mother and said, Mom, would you help? And of course her mother came immediately. It's no different than what some of you did this week when you came across a need that you have in your life right now, and you turned to God and you began to pray to him and you said, Lord, would you please intervene in this situation? How many of you this week asked God to help you in a situation? Just stick your hand up, okay? Yeah, there are more than just myself here and my wife who prayed over that one. Yeah, I mean, for most of us, we're doing this all the time. We have him on speed dial or on our favorites list, right? We're constantly calling God and we're asking for his help. Well, that's the picture that you have here. So what does Jesus do? Does he help? Verse 4. When he heard this, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. Jesus loved Martha, and here's that same word. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet, and you might circle the word yet, he loved them. Yet, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. See, Jesus wasn't exactly close by. He was 20, 25 miles away. He was in Judea or Perea, that area there. I should say he was in Perea. He's got to come back to Judea, to Bethany of Judea. So he gets the word, and what does he do? Does he help? Well, you could say there's kind of a yes help here and there's a no help here. There's a yes help here in that he explains what's going to ultimately happen to Lazarus. Lazarus is going to be okay. He knew that. He knew that things would work out. And some of you that know the rest of this story in John chapter 11, you know that it's going to work out. That ultimately he doesn't permanently die. So when Jesus says here he won't die, he's talking about how he's not going to permanently die. And ultimately what's going to happen is going to end up glorifying God and bring glory to Jesus. So Jesus says, yes, there's something that's going to happen here, but it's going to ultimately exalt God and praise God through what's going to take place. So that's the explanation, and we say, whew, that's good to know. Lazarus is going to be okay. But there's a no part of this, and the no part of him going to help is he stayed. He didn't leave where he was. He stayed in Perea for 2 more days. Listen, leaving Martha and Mary and Lazarus to wonder if he cared. Because word didn't go back to them. He stayed for possibly, there's going to end up being about 4 to 6 days of time where they have no idea what's going on. You say, how do you get the 4 to 6 days? Because 20 miles away or 25 miles away would take 1 or 2 days to travel by messenger. So you got 1 or 2 days on the front end of this thing before Jesus gets the message. Then he gets the message and he says, we're going to stay. It's going to all work out. And I don't think he told them at this point that he was going to stay for 2 more days, but the text tells us that's what happened. He ended up staying for 2 more days. But then you got on the other side of all of that, Jesus then having then to travel to Bethany, another 1 or 2 days. So it could have easily been 4 to 6 days. But here's what I want you to get out of this. Has God ever done this in your life? Where you've gone to him, maybe it's right now, and you said, I need help. And it's like the other end of the phone line went dead. That's what it was for them. Don't put yourself in the end of this story. Put yourself in this story right where the story is right now. They don't know about the explanation, and they're going to end up not seeing him come. Every day it's going to be the same thing. Is Jesus here yet? Have you seen Jesus? Do you know where Jesus is? Maybe they had people come to them. I thought you sent word to Jesus about Lazarus and his sickness. Have you seen him yet? Is he coming? No, they didn't know. C.S. Lewis had a similar experience in his life when his wife was diagnosed with cancer, and he turned to God and he asked God to help. And he reflected on what happened in his book. I don't know if you've read it, A Grief Observed, but he said this: when you are happy, so happy you have no sense of needing him, so happy that you're tempted to feel his claims upon you as an interruption, if you remember yourself and turn to him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain. And what do you find? A door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. And after that, silence. I'll bet you there are a number of us here this morning that can identify with that. You go to God and you're praising him and it's like, yeah, there's a special connection here. But you go to God with this problem and it's is he there? Does he care? You ever felt like that? Feel like that right now? I mean, this is troubling enough when we send somebody an email and they don't reply, right? I don't know how you feel about that. I mean, we're kind of the people of, you send somebody an email, you'd like to know what they're thinking within 5 minutes. I thought you were online, like all the time or something. Let me know what you think. And we send somebody an email and they don't reply. What happens then for you? You're like, do they care? Are they dead? You know, are they going to help me? I told them I got a problem. We need to get together, and I don't hear a thing from them. And it could be very frustrating even to send an email. That's why I encourage the staff around here, while I try to do this, to at least get back, and for no other reason, just to say, I got your email, but I don't have time to answer it right now, but I will some year. And, you know, I'm sure I'm going to get back to you, but not yet. I mean, just so they know, right? And what you have here is a whole different situation. This is much worse than an email. We're talking about a message that was sent concerning a brother who is sick, and they don't know whether or not he's going to live. They don't know what's going to happen with him, and there's no reply that comes back, none at all. So what was Jesus saying at this point by his actions? He was saying, not yet. We know he was going to help, but not yet. Those with Jesus knew that everything was going to turn out okay and that something would be done, but not yet. But those who put in, Martha and Mary and the others, who put in a 911 call to Jesus had no idea how this whole thing was going to turn out. So what happens? 2 days pass. We pick up the account in verse 7. Then he said to his disciples, let us go back to Judea. And at this point you're thinking, so this is good, finally. But, it says in verse 8, Rabbi, they said, a short while ago the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you are going back there? In other words, the disciples disagreed with what Jesus was saying now that he was going to do. And of course, they know better than Jesus. So they say to him, are you crazy? Why would you go back to a place where they almost killed you the last time we were there? We like the idea that we don't need to go back there, okay? Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It's when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light. And you read that, and I read that the first time, and you say, and what does that have to do with anything? Well, they had daylight hours to work in, right? And basically it says there about 12 hours a day of daylight. They didn't work at night with some electricity like we do. And so Jesus is saying that there is a limited number of hours of daylight where this work can get done. And by saying that, he is saying, I'm here to do God's work. I'm here to do God's will. We need to therefore walk in the light while we have the light. We need to bring the light of life into a world that's plagued by darkness. And darkness is happening over there in Bethany, and we need to go back while we have time, while we're permitted to do this work. So guys, we're going to go back. So pick up the account in verse 11. After he had said this, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going to go there to wake him up. His disciples replied, Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better. Don't you just love the naivety of these guys? Because it just so much is like us so many times. They take this thing at face value. That's a good thing. He's sleeping. And if you're sick, then sleep is like a really good idea because people get better when they sleep. So especially if you're sick, you need to sleep. Jesus, it says, verse 13, had been speaking of his death, Lazarus' death. But his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe. But let us go to him. Verse 16, then Thomas called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. See, in their minds, if we go, we're dead. That's all they can think about. But what Jesus is expressing here is the fact that he cares. He cares about what's going on. And after 2 days, it was time to go express that care. And I want you to just notice carefully from this text how much he cares, how he shows his care. He shows his care, first of all, through his caring words and saying, guys, we got to go back. Maybe a dangerous situation, but we got to go back to bring light into a dark situation. Lazarus needs us. He expressed his care, listen, in his omniscient awareness. Even though Jesus is 20, 25 miles away, he knew as God that Lazarus was now dead and he needed him. He expressed his care by his planned action. He was going to go back and wake Lazarus up from his sleep. And by the way, the Bible oftentimes refers to death as sleep. That's my favorite expression for death, sleep, which expresses something that's temporary. He expresses his care by his courageous willingness to sacrifice his life, knowing that he's going to go back and surely death awaits him. In fact, that's what ultimately follows, because after Jesus gets back, we're going to get into this shortly in February and so, Jesus is arrested, and then Jesus is tried, and then ultimately Jesus is crucified. But Jesus is willing to go back and to make the sacrifice so that people can have the light of life. By the way, if you don't know that, I don't know where you are in this journey, but I hope you continue in this journey with God to begin to discover that, because Jesus came to make a sacrifice for all of us so that all of us could have an eternal relationship with God. We have sin. We have sinned against God. We continue to sin against God. Our sin separates us from God, and we need a Savior, and Jesus came to make it possible for us to be saved for all eternity. That's the gospel. That's the good news of salvation that's found in Jesus Christ. It is his death on the cross is the ultimate expression of his care. But then also you see here his care expressed in the promised outcome. At this point, he doesn't tell him how the whole thing's going to turn out. Again, don't get ahead of this story. He's going to raise Lazarus from the dead. But when it happens, he says, but this is what's going to happen. His death is so that you will come to believe. And so that others will come to believe. So there's a purpose behind his death. So that ultimately people will come to believe and they'll end up exalting and they'll end up praising God. But before he goes, he waits 2 additional days. And finally, after those 2 additional days, he finally says, okay, now, let's go. And in saying okay, now, he is saying, all right, now we're going to go back and we're going to show the love of God in this situation where there is a need. But Mary and Martha and Lazarus don't know any of that. And from their perspective, the absence of Jesus in coming would seem wrong. Wrong. There's an interesting historical fact. At that time, people held on to a superstitious belief that when a person died, their spirit hovered over their dead body for 3 days, which meant that it could be possible for that person to still rise from the dead. And it may be that Jesus' delay was intended also to remove any superstitious belief or interpretation of the miracle that would ultimately come. What we know is that Jesus waited long enough for one, Lazarus, to die, and he ultimately waits long enough to prevent any kind of superstitious explanation of what ultimately happened to Lazarus. But while he is waiting and all of that is transpiring, Martha and Mary are waiting in the dark, seeing things go from bad, Lazarus is sick, to worse, and Lazarus is now dead. And there's no Jesus. C.S. Lewis reflected on ultimately his wife's death. In Grief Observed, while he was waiting, while he was praying, he wrote this. He said, as he reflected back on it, "Knock and it shall be opened." Maybe you've heard that verse in the Bible, to knock and to ask and to seek. And so Lewis said, "Knock and it shall be opened." But does knocking mean hammering and kicking the door like a maniac? Because that's what it became for Lewis in his desperation. Until ultimately his wife died, and then he reflected back on that time and said this: it was like the death of a beloved is an amputation. And when that happened to him, just like it happened to Mary and Martha, he was left to answer the question we're going to talk about next week, which is why. Why did this happen? Because all they knew at this point in time was that Jesus wasn't doing something about this situation. Things weren't turning out like they had hoped they would. It wasn't turning out like planned that Jesus will come and do something. Life wasn't going to end, evidently, happily ever after. The whole situation just seemed wrong. Except to one person. The one person on planet Earth at that moment in time who knew it wasn't wrong was Jesus. And quite frankly, what was happening was working out perfectly, just as he had planned it to be. But if you're left asking, does Jesus care, what do you conclude? As I was looking at this passage, here's what I conclude. Yes, he cares more than you know. More than you know right now. See, all the facts weren't revealed. He cares more than we know right now. And he was just about ready to prove it. He was just about ready to do a work that ultimately would be beyond anything that they would have asked or dreamed. It wasn't even in their mind that their brother would die and ultimately their brother would be resurrected from the dead. He wasn't telling them that. He didn't even hint at that, in a sense, what he was going to ultimately do. They didn't know the whole story. All he was asking them to do, listen to this, all he was asking them to do is the same thing that he asked us to do when there's a delay and when there's silence. And you know what that is? He asked us to trust him and to wait upon his time. He was asking them to trust him. He was asking them to trust in the God whose loving kindnesses are new every morning, whose faithfulness is great. He was asking them to believe that his time, that God's time, that Jesus' time was the right time. And so these two factors oftentimes come together in the development of our faith, in changing us into be people that God wants us to grow into. Trust and time. And it's not perfect, because sometimes we tend to trust more than we do at other times. But both of those factors were coming together in this delay to grow his children to maturity in Christ. As God would have it, in my personal devotions, I've been reading Tim Keller's book, King's Cross. And in it, Pastor Keller says this about God's delays. He said, "So often, if God seems to be unconscionably delaying his grace and committing malpractice in our life, it's because there's some crucial information that we don't have yet. Some essential variable that's unavailable to us." This is exactly what was happening here. There's some essential information that Mary, Martha, and Lazarus didn't have, even the disciples. So Keller writes, if I could sit down with you and listen to the story of your life, it may well be that I would join you in saying, I can't understand why God isn't coming through. I don't know why he's delaying. Believe me, I know how you feel. So I want to be sensitive, he says, in the way I put this. But when I look at the delays of God in my own life, I realize that a great deal of my consternation has been rooted in arrogance. I complain to Jesus, okay, you're the eternal Son of God, you live for an eternity, you created the universe, but why would you know any better than I do how my life should be going? We're not God. But we have such delusions of grandeur that our own self-righteousness and arrogance sometimes have to be knocked out of our heart by God's delays. Certainly a strong possibility that God's delay in our life may be that he's just trying to change us into something that we aren't right now. But one thing we know, God cares more than I know. Remember Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11, where it says, I know the plans that I have for you. You may not know those plans, but I do. I know that you need a job. But I also know more than you know right now. I care about your family, I really do. But I also know more than you know right now. I have a plan. I care about your health, I do. But I care more, I know more than you do right now. I know about that financial need. I know about that relational challenge. And while we're waiting, what he's asking us to do is to trust his loving care. Like Proverbs 3 says, to trust in the Lord with all of our heart and to lean not on our own understanding. And we so oftentimes in the midst of a situation where it doesn't make sense are trying to make sense of this. And so it says, so lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him and he will make your paths straight. To rest in the Lord, Psalm 37 says, rest in the Lord and to wait patiently for him. Or Psalm 46, here's a great psalm to study this week in your personal devotions. Psalm 46:10, to be still and know that I am God. After a ton of turmoil, Lewis finally came to acceptance on this, and this is what he wrote in A Grief Observed. God has not been trying an experiment on my faith or love in order to find out their quality. He knew it already. It was I who didn't. In this trial, he makes us occupy the dock, the witness box, and the bench all at once. He always knew that my temple was a house of cards. His only way of making me realize the fact was to knock it down. And so perhaps with God, I have gradually been coming to feel that the door is no longer shut and bolted. Was it my own frantic need that slammed it in my face? The time when there is nothing at all in your soul except a cry for help may be just the time when God can't give it. You are like the drowning man who can't be helped because he clutches and grabs. Perhaps your own reiterated cries deafen you to the voice you hope to hear. See, what Lewis came to believe is that God was working and speaking even during the silence. And it may be that God is working and speaking even during the silence in your life right now. And what he wants to say to all of us this morning is he cares. He cares more than we know. Rob's going to come back up. We're going to continue our time of worship and think about this for a few minutes. Lord's been talking to you just like he's been talking to me about this week. And so I just want to ask you to reflect just for a moment as Rob comes and sings this song. Reflect for just a moment on what is it that God's saying to you right now? What's going on in your life right now? Why did he put you here this morning to be a part of this worship service? What is he saying to you right now? And then there's kind of a second question here. What is it that he wants you to do about it? What does he want you to do? Let's just take a few moments to reflect on that. Rob's going to sing. And then after he does, we'll just take a moment to even share some of this with each other this morning. What's happening in your life right now that God's trying to speak into to help you become the person that you want to be, that He wants you to be as well? Let's listen and think.